Sci-Fi Show Outcast. Welcome to the 26th Sci-Fi Show Outcast. Today I've got an interesting interview with Dr. Quinton Smith on the philosophy of physics and other bits and pieces. Pretty interesting interview. I enjoyed doing it. So, let's just get straight into it. Thank you for joining us on the Sci-Fi Show today, Dr. Smith.
I'm glad to be here and to talk.
So, can you tell me a bit about yourself? Who are you and what you've done?
Well, I guess in terms of the external matters of my sort of conventional identification in my culture would be, I'd use words like, well, I'm a professor of philosophy of physics in the Department of Philosophy at Western Michigan University in Michigan, United States, published, I think, 11 books and 140 articles. But that's sort of my cultural identity. As to who I really am, I think I probably would say, well, no, that's not who I really am. That's how I'm supposed to interpret myself in terms of our cultural criteria. But who I really am, I would say, I'm pretty sure I'm a member of the human species, Homo sapiens, and it seems to be good enough evidence for that. And I looks like I'm located in the outer parts of the Milky Way galaxy, about 3/4 out from the center. And the Milky Way galaxy contains 400 billion stars, including our sun. And our Milky Way galaxy, from what I can gather, is heading towards the Andromeda galaxy, and it's going to crash into it. I mean, estimates vary, but one estimate is in 5 billion years. So they won't have to worry about that unless they get some vents and live forever mechanism. That whole thing is a part of the Virgo supercluster, like the Andromeda Galaxy and the Milky Way Galaxy. And that is receding from all the other superclusters of galaxies. And they're all receding from each other. And the further away they are from each other, the faster they're receding. And so you think of that and say, well, what could possibly explain that? Well, you time reverse it, and then instead of receding from each other, they come close to each other, then you just like rolling a film backwards, then they all pile on top of each other at the very beginning and crush each other down to a point, which is something that cosmologists and astronomers talk about. Well, I wonder if, can we really conceive that? I mean, I think it's true, but imagine trying to conceive that. We have, just take our own galaxy. There's 400 billion stars in it, and just one of them is the one's our sun. Now imagine 400 billion of them all crushed down. Well, let's start from the Big Bang when it starts off. So right now, based on the latest evidence since 1998, since they saw two supernova, that was kind of decisive evidence that the universe will expand forever and won't contract. And so all these supercluster galaxies will keep receding from each other. But if we want to figure out what happened at the beginning, we can, in our minds, roll the tape back, and we will find out that they're all piled on top of each other, squeezed into each other. They become almost instantly dense. And at one time, all these galaxies and superclusters of galaxies, they're all packed into a space smaller than an atom. And then an even earlier time, they were all packed into a space smaller than an electron. And then earlier than that, they were packed into the space about 1/100th the size of an electron. Now, that's sort of part of this model of physics. But can we really imagine that? Imagine there's billions of galaxies, and each contain between 200 and 400 billion stars. And then, of course, the Earth is pretty tiny compared to any of them. But the Earth and all of them were all originally at the Big Bang, were packed so tightly together, were like 1/10 or 1/100th the size of an electron. And that's all that exists. And the Big Bang is just that densely packed matter just exploding. And what we see now is all the superclusters of galaxies that are receding from us in every direction. That's just the continuation of the explosion. So the explosion happened, began 15 billion years ago. That's the most common given estimate. I mean, they often vary between 13 and 20, but usually 15 is what they hit on, 15 billion years ago. And ever since then, the whole universe has been in the process of exploding. So right now, we're all living inside of an explosion, except this is the longest explosion anyone's ever seen. I mean, considered so far, it's lasted 15 billion years, and that's still going on. So our whole lives and the whole universe, the whole history of the universe, will be this history of this explosion. Because as this explosion goes on, it'll eventually, I guess there are two possibilities. There used to be thought before 1998 that it went on and on forever. The explosion would gradually slow down, so the galaxies would gradually slow down as they got further apart from each other. But now they discovered this new force as a consequence of these 1998 observations of these supernova are exploding stars. And they found out that the universe in its expansion is actually speeding up in its expansion. And they call that an anti-gravity force. I tried to get them to call it quintessence, as they did for a month on a magazine, but they dropped it. That anti-gravity force is pushing everything apart. And so it looks like instead of this explosion slowing down, this explosion is going to speed up, and everything is going to start receding from each other faster and faster and faster until if it goes on for an infinite amount of time, eventually the explosion will be going almost an infinite velocity. I take any velocity, like 10 billion miles a second. It'll be going that fast, and then it'll be still faster as you go more future into time. And once you get into this area as to what happens then we're beyond what is part of what's known, then we're into speculation as to what happens then. But one speculation, well, maybe I shouldn't mention any speculations just to make sure that speculations don't get mixed up with science here. So actually what it is that people don't know what's going to happen in the future, except that the expansion is speeding up. And so our explosion is making all the superclusters of galaxies recede from each other, greater and greater velocities as time goes by.
Okay.
And now that was an answer to the question of I think, who am I really?
Yes.
Yeah, I'm a part of this explosion. That's who I am. You know, I'm just a fragment of an explosion. That's about it.
Fair enough.
Okay.
So how would you describe your worldview on the whole?
Worldview? In terms of, current scientific theories, there's several alternatives you can take given current established science, because some parts of science are inconsistent with others, so you can choose different parts. If that's what you mean, then I would find those possible. The experiments that have been done beginning since 1980 and 81, showing that there's instantaneous causal correlations between distant subatomic particles, where they go far faster than the speed of light. They go metaphorically infinitely fast, which means instantaneously. Like in a very instant, the cause exists. At that very same instant, the effect exists. No matter how far away the effect is, the effect could be, you know, several galaxies away from here. And what that shows is we're in trouble, because Einstein's theory of relativity says nothing can go faster than light, and this goes faster than light. I mean, their technical name, if you want to read about them, is the EPR correlations. And EPR correlations, not only do they go faster than light, but they violate almost every single one of the principles of Einstein's relativity theory, both the special and general relativity. Because his theory says that something can cause something else only if the cause is in the past and the effect is in the future. And he doesn't allow for two things to simultaneously cause each other. But according to this EPR correlations, these experiments they were done by Elaine Aspect and several other people, and they were trying to verify a theorem of J.S. Bell. He was trying to work out some mathematical proof that simultaneity wasn't relative, and he ended up with this hypothesis. And so experimenters began experimenting it, and they found out it was right, that causal processes go instantaneously fast. Time is not, the relativity of time requires that light be the highest speed anything can go, which is 186,000 miles per hour. And so these causal correlations, EPR causal correlations, they're instantaneous. They go across the entire universe, and they cause things. They violate Einstein again by it's not a past thing causing a future effect. It's two present things, there's A and there's B. And A, when it's a present, simultaneously causes B. And it's also action at a distance. And it's also called non-locality, in the sense that Einstein insisted that the basis of his relativity theory is locality, meaning that for anything to cause something else, it has to contact it, physically contact it. But with these EPR correlations, the subatomic things that are causes and effects, like this spin of a quark or the spin of a proton or something like that, the cause, let's say we had a subatomic particle, a quark, and if you're not quite sure what that is, just say it's an electron. It could also be an electron, nucleus of an atom, or even possibly an atom, so any one of those things. So let's say we take one of those things, we start off with a quark, and we make it so it spins in one direction, and that instantaneously makes something in another galaxy spin in the opposite direction at that very same instant. And so what that shows is that there is absolute simultaneity and absolute causal relationships. And the problem with that is that means Einstein's general theory of relativity is wrong, and his special theory of relativity is wrong. And the special theory being wrong is not so bad, because there is a theory in hand we can use to replace it, which is Lorenz's theory. Because Lorenz's theory, way back in 1905, when Einstein first published it, there was a big debate between Lorenz and Einstein. Lorenz posited this absolute simultaneity, and Einstein didn't. Einstein won the debate. But now people are saying, well, Lorenz won it, because the empirical evidence favors Lorenz. But the real problem is the general theory of relativity, because that's our theory of gravity, our theory of what space and time is, and it's our cosmology, Big Bang cosmology. So if all that is falsified by this instantaneous EPR correlations, then that means we have no theory of gravity. We have no theory of space and time, and we have no theory of the universe as a whole. and there's no one has any idea of how to start going about finding such a theory to replace the general theory of relativity. So what they do is they just forget about it. No, it's just too overwhelming. So they've kind of locked away in the closet and say, well, we'll just leave this, you know, for the next generation or next two or three generations. And what the main work I'm trying to do in physics is trying to give physicists some idea of directions in which they can look to try and start constructing a theory to replace the general theory of relativity. And that involves a lot of literature that no one's read because no one thought it was relevant. So it's all been marginalized literature. And part of it is called a neo-Newtonian Big Bang cosmology. It started in the 1930s. It's not really actually Newton's theory, but they just used some of Newton's mathematics. That was started by Milne, McCrae, and people like that, and Lemaître. And the other is Lorentz Big Bang cosmology. And I'm trying to integrate those with some other ideas to try and give a kind of a picture, including the mathematics, that physicists can look at it and see where kind of direction they can go in to try and start building up a new theory to replace general relativity. Because right now, like if you ask somebody, well, general relativity has been disconfirmed by these EPR correlations. Can you think of any theory to replace general relativity? People's mind go blank, completely blank. So what I'm trying to do is trying to get some basic idea, not only just a picture of the universe, but also equations, so the mind won't go blank. So they'll be able to think of something, then they can start building on that instead of just hiding the problem, which is what they're really doing. They're hiding it and tucking it away and just leaving it for someone else to try and solve, you know, in 50 or 100 years or something. I don't think that's good science. If you run into a problem, you lock it into a closet and forget about it.
Okay.
That undermines all of the quantum gravity program, like string theory and Hawking's theory and so on, because that's all based on the belief that general relativity is not disconfirmed by any evidence. So all these physicists, most of all the creative physicists, are working on string theory. So it's a wasted effort because we need to unify general relativity with quantum mechanics. If general relativity is false, it would be like trying to unify Newton's mechanics or Aristotle's mechanics with quantum physics. And no one would do that because there's no point to it because they know that Newton's theory and Aristotle's theory have been falsified. But if Einstein's general theory of relativity is falsified, then there's no point to try and unify it with quantum mechanics. Because supposedly the main crisis in physics now is that general relativity is inconsistent with quantum mechanics. And all these quantum gravity programs like string theory and Hawking's no boundary theory, they're trying to make general relativity consistent with quantum mechanics. But I'm saying, well, this is a wasted effort because you're dealing one of those two theories is false, general relativity. And you're going to have to ban whatever you come up with. You're going to have to abandon anyway because general relativity is false. And what we need to combine quantum mechanics with is what theory we come up with to replace general relativity. And part of the approach I'm using to trying to outline this new theory, and certainly I'm not going to do it, like it's a massive project requiring thousands of physicists over a couple of generations. But I'm just trying to give them a basic picture so the mind isn't just blank when you ask them, well, what do you place general relativity with? In this theory, unification of quantum mechanics with the theory of space-time and gravity is automatic because if you use Bohm's quantum mechanics, in his 1952 interpretation, he deduces Newton's first and second laws of motion, and he includes Newton's space and time. And so that's a non-quantum theory. And so since that's implied by Bohm's quantum theory, that right there is a unification. That's a quantum gravity theory. We have Bohm unified with Newton. of course, to have that have any relevance at all, you have to show, you have to develop some theory where a neo-Newtonian theory that is predictably accurate enough and mathematically adequate enough so it can replace general relativity, but that's a large task. Some people began working on it in the 1930s, then they sort of lost interest because everyone just accepted general relativity. But now they didn't start working on it again in 1981 once the EPR correlations were known, because right then it was known that Einstein's general relativity was false, and then that neo-Newtonian cosmology, since it allowed instantaneous absolute simultaneity, that was consistent with the EPR correlations. And so they should have kept on developing it then, but they didn't. And so I'm going to try and develop what they'd left just standing still in the 1930s and try and develop it further and overcome. I mean, there's a lot of problems in the theory that they've developed. And I'm going to try and, well, I guess obviously I can't overcome them all or even half, so I'm going to look for ways to outline certain suggestions as how certain problems might be solved. And that's the point of that is to stimulate physicists who read it to start working on that and stimulate them to get some ideas on it, so they can start working out some very mathematically precise theories and ones that they can drive predictions from.
Okay, so you're a philosopher of physics. What's a philosophy of physics?
Well, actually, since I'm in a philosophy department, it's sort of what I do automatically has that label. But I'm really, I'm doing physics. But don't tell the don't tell my university.
Okay.
So I'm not in the right department to do physics. So I do physics and publish physics. Gets counted as philosophy of physics. Actually, it is kind of odd because other university professors, they've done that. They've transferred from physics departments to philosophy departments. Then all of a sudden it works. They write the exact same stuff, and it gets reclassified as philosophy of physics, even though all that's changed is the department they're in. So it's kind of an arbitrary distinction between the two. So I might get a joint appointment at some physics department. Well, I won't confuse people by saying I do physics, but I'm in the philosophy department.
Okay. So what do you think are the philosophical implications of quantum mechanics?
Well, my current view, I'm not sure any of that's on my site. I used to hold Hartle's and Hawking's view, but I don't anymore. Right now I hold a certain interpretation of Bohm's version of quantum mechanics. And I think the most interesting overall in terms of looking at all the alternate questions in physics and philosophy is that Bohm's quantum mechanics, you have this universe-wide, it's just like an EPR causal correlation, and it's called a quantum potential relationship. And it causes everything and guides everything to do different things instantaneously. And now that's the way the Big Bang can be explained as starting, because at that time, the quantum potential can not only cause, well first of all, it can cause all the matter and energy in the universe. And so you got an answer there to, you know, what's the cause of the Big Bang? It'd be the quantum potential. But then the end of question becomes, well, what's the cause of the quantum potential? And this is something I think can be shown to follow from Bohm's theory, but it's not an established part of science. So this shouldn't be mistaken for established science. So I am getting like half speculative right here. I guess my idea is that the Q potential, at the very first instant it existed, it brought itself into existence because there are numerous different definitions of causality in philosophy, and several of them allow for simultaneous causation. And so imagine this Q cupotential as an infinitely long series of pencils lined up, or a finite long. Actually, either case will do. And they're lined up in a line. Now, what the EPR correlations do, and the cupotential, they simultaneously cause something that's very distant from them. And each of those pencils causes another distant pencil to come into existence. And while it's doing that, another pencil, a third pencil that's very far distant, is causing the first pencil to come into existence. And so two things are happening simultaneously. Each of those pencils is coming into existence, and is coming into existence is at the same time an act of causing some other distant pencil to come into existence. And then when the distant pencil comes into existence, that causes some other distant pencils to come into existence. So that way the quantum potential can create itself simultaneously.
Okay.
Now, the idea that would be theoretically and conceptually coherent, but it never would start belonging to standard physics unless you could imagine some type of experiment. Obviously, you can't do it at the beginning of the universe, but some other situation where that happened, and no one has done that yet. And so it's right now you can deduce that from the theory, but of course, if you're doing philosophy, then that you'd be finished right there. That's all you do. You know, that's what you call philosophical knowledge. You deduce it from your theory. But the scientists would say, okay, you deduce it from your theory. Now give it the real test to see whether it's right or not. You know, do an experiment. And so it won't become part of standard physics until someone can think of some experiment. I can't think of any. But I'm going to try and publish it in journals that experimental physicists read, and hopefully they'll be able to think of something.
Okay. Now, I also noticed on your website you had a comment on quantum cosmology and atheism. Is this because you think the universe caused itself, as you just suggested, or how does that work?
Right. Yeah, right. Well, actually, that's my present view. And I used to hold in 1990 Stephen Hawking's view, which was Stephen Hawking cosmology is called the no boundary cosmology. And it has a law of nature that predicts the probability that a universe of the type of ours will come into existence uncaused out of nothingness. And Hawking has been able to do some predictions for like a universe with smooth matter and it's the universe is all regularly ordered, so it looks the same in every direction on very large scales. It's called isotropic. And also that our universe is almost like Euclidean space. So it's not very curved. And he's managed to predict for that the probability is 100% that a universe like ours will come into existence uncaused. And the way he does that is he takes all possible universes, then he uses Richard Feynman's sum over histories, and then all the histories of the universes that are not like ours have very abnormal and impossible structures, and they end up canceling each other out. I mean, just to give a simple idea of what canceling each other out means, let's say that one of these kind of deformed universes, if I want to use that word, let's say it has a structure with is measured by the number 5. Of course, obviously, the whole thing would be way more complicated than that. And then one of the other histories of another universe will be -5. And so these two universes will cancel each other out, the +5 and the -5. Then you'll have a +4 and a -4. And for every number, for every plus number, positive number, you'll have a negative number that will cancel out, except there's one universe that's left over with nothing to cancel it out, and that's our universe. And so he predicts with 100% probability that our universe will begin to exist without a cause. Of course, that relates to the people interested in the philosophy of religion, both that theory and the Bohm theory of this quantum potential causing itself at the first instant of time, I was talking about the long line of pencils, both those theories imply that God doesn't exist, because God, of course, God, in fact, every person who is not a philosopher of religion, they define God differently. So, and philosophers have gotten to a habit of just deciding on one meaning of the word. And they say, well, God's going to be the perfect being. And that's going to be the being that's all-knowing and all-powerful and perfectly good, free creator of the universe. And so part of the definition of God is that if there was a universe, that he is the cause of it. Now, both Stephen Hawking's theory, says if there was a universe, it's uncaused, which implies that God doesn't exist. Then on the theory of Bohm's theory of the Q potential, which the Q potential creates itself simultaneously and also creates the next state of the universe, that also implies God doesn't exist, because God can't create the universe.
Okay. So a slightly strange idea, but I think it makes sense.
Hawking's theory is quantum gravity. And all quantum gravity theories, as their own people who expound them admit, are just speculations, because they're not mathematically complete at all. And they are approximations to an approximation to approximation to approximation to the master equation, they call it, which is really the quantum gravity equation. So they're really way far off from the mathematical equation. And secondly, they have no testable consequences. So Hawking's idea about the sum over histories and things cancel each other out, that's just speculation. So if you're a theist and believe in God, that's not worth debating about, because Hawking will grant from the beginning it's speculation, there's no evidence whatsoever that it's true. But there is, if you want a philosophy of religion argument, it's based on the most established idea, which is that universe began in a Big Bang. Now, if you take the first second of the universe's existence, then you divide that into two half seconds, then you divide the earlier half second into 2 1/4 seconds, then you divide that into 2 1/8 seconds, and you keep on dividing down, and you get down to things like 1/10,000,000 or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
But you keep on going. But what happens is you since there are infinite number of fractions, you never run out. And each of those fractions corresponds to an earlier state of the Big Bang. And each earlier state will cause a later state. And there'll be no earlier state because there's no smallest fraction. And so there's nothing in the Big Bang that God could cause, because each stage of the Big Bang is caused by an earlier stage of the Big Bang. So you can put, loosely speaking, the Big Bang causes itself, but not in the same way the Q potential did, which caused itself. That's more speculative anyway. That caused itself in one instant, instantaneously. But the non-speculative idea, which is part of the established science, is with Freeman's Big Bang universe, is that each earlier state in the first second will be shorter than the state following it, but also will cause part of that state. And so there's no state in the Big Bang that's not caused by an earlier state. So you might call the Big Bang something that successively self-caused or something. But then again, you get the word self, because it's really not something singular. It's plural. You have infinite number of states. So it's really to say all the states of the Big Bang are caused, and each of the states are caused by earlier states. And there's no state that's not caused. Then that itself would entail that God does not exist, because there's nothing for God to cause there, since everything already is caused.
Okay. So you'd disagree with your colleague William Lane Craig on the Kalam cosmological argument then?
Yeah, we've had some debates about that at universities, and we've written a number of articles arguing about it, and we keep on, like, he responds to me and I respond to him, and we keep on coming up with further arguments to try and show the other person is wrong. And he, if anyone sees him next, tell him he hasn't responded to the essay in the book God and Time.
Okay.
If he wants to keep the debate going and respond, he has to do that.
Okay. So, Dr. Smith, if people wanted to learn more about the ideas we've been discussing in this show, where would be a good place to go?
Well, both the references to things written by other people and the things I've written about it, and within the things I've written about it, I refer to other people who write about opposite views to me because I'd argue against them. They're but 3/4 of the things that I've written I've put up on the website, so they can just you don't have to like search out the article somewhere, just get to the website and find it and read it.
I'll put a link to it in the show notes so everyone can find it.
Okay. So that's a
well, thank you very much for your time today.
Okay, well, I appreciate you very much.
Well, I hope everybody enjoyed that interview. You can find links to Dr. Smith's stuff in the show notes. I'll talk to you next time. The Sci-Fi Show is copyright Jason Rennie, 2006. It's released under a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial No Derivatives License, and the song Big Planet is used by permission of Nova Surfer. More great Nova Surfer tracks can be found at novasurfer.ml.